Welcome back to Happy Porch Radio, the digital agency podcast for progressive agency owners and web professionals. Season 4 is an exploration of diversity in our industry, especially gender diversity. This season, your host, Barry O'Kane, is joined by some wonderful co-hosts for conversations with agency leaders and diversity and inclusion experts.
Hello and welcome back to Happy Porch Radio. This is the second of a two-part conversation with Dan Robertson. Dan is an expert on workplace diversity and inclusion, unconscious bias, and inclusive leadership. Be sure to check out the previous episode for part one. So, on with the conversation.
I'm really wondering about when we look at really small teams. So we're a team of nine, and you know, a lot of agencies are kind of on the smaller end of the spectrum to much larger organisations that might have a women's group, for instance, or an LGBT network. It seems like we need to expose ourselves to people that aren't like us in order to mitigate our bias, which is, I can see that that's a really sensible and good idea. But when it comes to mitigating the bias in, say, recruitment, there seems to be a bit of a clash between, it feels like in a small team, you do need people that you get on with and people that you kind of have, you know, shared interest with and similarities, because you're going to, there's not many of you and that culture is kind of important in the small team. So how do you manage actively not recruiting people who are like you, but maintaining a culture where everybody kind of gets on? I mean, I know getting on with people and people who are like you are not mutually exclusive, but there seems to be a bit of a clash there.
Yeah, that's a super interesting question, Kate, actually. And you know, in many ways, having people who are similar to you, particularly in small teams, and actually even if we take these big institutions, you know, institutions that employ thousands of people, really they're a set of kind of micro businesses, because most of us work in small teams anyway. So it's a really interesting question about, the balancing act. I suppose what I would say is when you have people who are similar to you, that has lots of positive consequences in terms of being in a team. One is people who are similar, we can predict their behavior. Organizational decision-making can be a lot quicker, and in many ways, it can be a lot more efficient. Bringing people in who are different and maybe on the edges of being quite different from us, sometimes that can be quite difficult to manage those differences, actually, and decision-making can slow down. I suppose what I would say is, it's a balancing act. And I think at some point, as the team kind of expands, we need to think about where are we on the scale of, let's say at one end you've got similarity and one end you've got difference. Do we feel we've got an equilibrium? Even if we've got a tiny team of just, you know, 4 or 5 people or 9 or 10 people, if we feel that when we've got, you know, 6 or 7 that are a bit similar, actually then the 8th person that we hire, then we can afford to have a bit more difference. So it's kind of, I don't know what, you know, a metaphor would be, but it's that kind of whole metaphor perhaps of, you know, having a tap which is lukewarm. Have we got too much cold? Have we got too much hot in there? And constantly readjusting to make sure that we've got that balance. But of course, when we've got too much hot, that's not good. And when it goes too cold, that's not good either. So I do think these can apply much definitely to small teams as well as larger organisations as well.
I think the challenge that, I know Kelly raised this as well in a previous episode, for in our experience of recruiting, we pick the most talented artist for the job. And that has to come at a higher priority than whether our diversity and inclusion metrics are kind of equilibrium. And that's a kind of tricky one to balance, really, isn't it? I don't think we're doing a bad job when it comes to having a mix of people from different kind of walks of life and backgrounds and skill sets and personalities, but I can see how that might be a struggle for a lot of quite specialist roles and for smaller teams as well.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think, I mean, I am not a fan of quotas, actually, or positive discrimination. In fact, when we look at some of the models of that globally, I'm not convinced that actually that's had an effect in terms of bias mitigation and promoting cultures which are inclusive. So for me, as somebody who runs a global consultancy business, the thing that has to come above everything is talent. Do people have the right skills the right competencies, etc. What I would say, though, is two things, really. One is, how do we define talent? So what does talent to us look like? And does talent always look like what we already have? So what is the mold of talent? The other thing that I would say is, just as we have our own biases, what we find is, I suppose an interesting question is, what is the message that we're giving to the marketplace that we value diversity and inclusion? And there's lots of work around essentially positive action, which is not the same as positive discrimination, but positive action, you know, going out to the market, or when we're advertising, even doing something very, very simple, which is cost zero. If you put on a job advert, you know, we're an equal opportunities employer, that essentially means nothing to nobody, because we're so used to that. The signaling of that is probably quite redundant. But if you said, for example, or rewrote the sentence to, you know, we at company X are absolutely committed to diverse inclusion, we recognize that we're underrepresented by X group, we welcome you to apply, you're actually going to find that your attraction strategy goes up. Now, of course, you're still making sure that you absolutely recruit the best. You're not hiring people just because they're X or Y. But what you might find is that you get more diversity applying, and then that kind of helps you to increase your opportunity to hire somebody who's a bit different, but still has absolutely the skills and the talents that you're looking for. So I guess my encouragement to organizations would be, how proactive are you in terms of seeking and reaching out to talent, and not just kind of using traditional methods?
That's really interesting. So that's positive action as an alternative to positive discrimination. Is there anything else, as well as them being explicit on the job spec, is there anything else that people can do other than kind of reaching out to, say, women in tech groups, or, you know, that those kind of things to do a better job here?
I mean, there's things that definitely do work, actually. So, I mean, they sound very simple, but they are really quite effective. And again, they're almost cost zero. And one is just thinking about the imaging. So let's say, for example, you know, I was looking for a role in tech, and I go onto a company's website, and on the website, you know, all the images used are, you know, they're all male. I don't see any women, you know, in their imagery. If I was female, that would send quite a negative signal towards me. And obviously, if I was male, that would send a positive signal to me. So I would just encourage, you know, without going into the zone of political correctness, because what I'm describing here is the zone of what the evidence is saying is working, actually, which is, if people do see images of themselves on websites, you know, in, if you have a brochure, that kind of thing, that will have some kind of positive effect, actually, that will encourage people to apply. So looking at those things helps as well. Without going too techy, language itself actually is divided into two parts, and language is very gendered, actually. I mean, you only need to learn German or French to realize that, you know, actual words themselves are either masculine words or feminine words. But even in the English language, some words appeal much more to men, some words appeal much more towards women. But those words are embedded within job descriptions and person specs. So lots of companies now are using systems like Textio, which is the AI tool, which is designed to, you can simply just scan a job description or person spec into Textio, and that flags up some of the gendered words. And the work then is just take them out and just neutralize what a person spec or job description looks like. Fairly simple to do, but again, has shown to have quite a positive effect in terms of who actually ends up applying. So there's some there, what we might call sort of system redesign or de-biasing the system through things like, you know, being mindful of words, images, and, you know, being proactive, that kind of thing.
Cool. And in speaking of words, if we find ourselves in conversations on a day-to-day basis within the workplace where we might find colleagues to be quite biased in their approach to something, how can we, within a professional setting, how can we address that? Do we kind of call it out from an educational perspective, or is there a better way of dealing with it?
Yeah, I would just say call it out. But when I say I would call it out, I would definitely would call it out. But I think it's important, you know, we are in a world now where everybody is super, super sensitive of what they say. And what that leads to is a kind of a narrative around political correctness where people say, well, I can't say this, I can't say that. I mean, one thing to say is that, you know, the world of work would be, it would be incredibly dull and uninteresting if we couldn't have fun, if we couldn't have a joke, if we can, you know, just kind of, well, I'll just say on a thing, you know, if we can take the piss out of people we know, life would not be very interesting. So I think that we don't want to suck out the passion and energy of what work is about. But what we do want to do is have a framework around us, which enables us to, first of all, identify bias and then call it out. So, for example, it's not fun to tell jokes or make comments about people's sexual orientation. It's not fun to tell jokes or make comments about people's race or their gender or their religion or their disability. It's not fun to not invite somebody for lunch or for coffee because we perceive them as being introverted and the stereotype around that might be they're a bit boring. You know, so I think what we can do is have a framework to say there's loads of areas where we can have fun, but when we're having fun based on somebody's identity, that's a no-no. So I think we can call it out, but we don't have to call it out in an aggressive way or a finger-pointy way. We can call it out in a way which we feel is appropriate and say to our colleagues, look, we're all on a journey here. Nobody's perfect, but we, whether they're formal or informal, because many organizations have values which are not necessarily written down, but, you know, it is about saying, what do we value in this organization? And, you know, we value our colleagues. And so it's just a simple thing sometimes of saying to colleagues, look, just be mindful that how you might perceive something as being quite fun, but the other person might take it in a way which is quite intimidating or hostile to them. So I think we can, I think we have to call it out, actually, because if we don't call it out, we, whether we like it or not, we send a signal that it's kind of okay to make jokes, whether it's based on appearance or could be anything. It could be based on somebody's appearance or their body size, or, you know, we often stereotype around people's social accents. So yeah, I do think we need to call it out, but I think we can call it out in a way which doesn't, well, we've got a balance between how forceful or not we need to be depending on the scenario.
Interesting, you're using the word framework there to have to sort of be able to, I guess, a framework to be able to call it out. Is that when you're saying a framework there, do you mean something as explicit as let's sit down as a team and talk about this and talk about, you know, where the boundaries are, what we're comfortable with, and introduce language that makes that kind of so that when we actually have a calling out or when somebody needs to say something, we've had, you know, we've set a baseline and we've understood that, look, if I say, a very simple example, if I say, look, I'm uncomfortable with that, that means that I think we've strayed into this area. You know, do we need a sort of formal or informal conversation with the team around that? Or is it something more just do on an ad hoc as, you know, over time?
It's a bit of a balance. I mean, I think sometimes we can go over bureaucratic on this, but I think at the same time, we need some rules, I guess. I suppose if you think about health and safety, and I'm not sure health and safety is a good example because people do talk about the health and safety police, but I think actually we know that we have a set of rules which are sometimes, you know, stuck on a wall of, you know, more health and safety rule might be, I don't know, make sure you wear your seatbelt or, you know, don't run down the stairs, walk down the stairs, or, you know, these are very, very simple things. They're what we call like micro behaviors or micro rules. I don't think it's a bad thing actually to have a set of rules around inclusivity, and they could be based on a set of values. So, you know, a rule might be, which we would have in an organization would be, you know, actually, if you have a disagreement with somebody, you know, a rule would be, you know, we're not going to shout at each other. We're going to disagree in an adult way. And that's not necessarily a principle of inclusivity, but it could be. And there could be other rules around inclusivity, which is about saying something very simple. One of our clients organizes lots of social activities. And one of the rules that they have is that they ask each team member to make a suggestion for a social activity, which they do on a monthly basis. And that's become very inclusive because their previous social activities were really defined by a certain group of individuals. And again, their intention was really positive, but their social activities were very male. So drinking, football, things even like hunting, you know, those sorts of things, which on the surface you can say, well, anybody can go drinking, anybody can go hunting, anybody can play football. Well, the reality of life is that those things are actually very male-centric. So the intention is not to exclude, but lots of people just check out because they're just not interested in them because they're very male and they become quite competitive. Just simply by rotating ideas for social activities, it frees it up. And so, you know, we're not all going to necessarily love all the ideas, but the rule is, even if you don't love an idea that someone comes up with, we're going to engage in it passionately and with respect, because the next time we will suggest something which we would expect somebody else to engage with as well. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing actually to have a set of rules which are written down in an informal way, just as we would have a rule around or what we might call a policy around flexible working, for example. We have a rule around that, whether we encourage it or not. It doesn't matter, but at least everybody knows what the rule is.
Another sort of very slight tangent from that is, if, again, look, thinking about team, working with a team, and I want to sort of tackle our biases or basically challenge us so that we're not having a sort of groupthink, we're not all looking in at the same problem or the same thing in the same way. I wanted to tie that back to what I thought was really excellent advice when you said at the start or early on in the conversations about kind of when we're talking about mitigating bias and just exposing, as an individual, exposing myself to different things to rewire my brain, as you said, but then also being able to introduce that kind of thing to the team.
So again, I think with the team, you know, you can do some very simple things. You could run some workshops with team members, and those workshops could be, because particularly when you're working in a small team, and I've worked in many small teams, you know, historically I used to work in a number of charities. You know, these are teams of 10, 12 people. And over time, you get to know your team members and, you know, you form some good relationships with your team members. And then we kind of assume that we kind of know who each other are. And in many ways, we do. But what's really fascinating is, and we've ran many workshops where we, you know, do this kind of, you know, even though you've worked with people for 10 or odd years or maybe 5 or 10 years, we've ran these sessions where we say, tell us one thing new about yourself. And it's really fascinating in terms of things that people tell you, that you think you've got a complete picture of who this individual is, but you don't. And they might tell you some fairly trivial stuff in terms of actually they've started a new hobby or they've started a new thing at the weekend. Or they might tell you something which is really quite personal in terms of, you know, things like actually when they were a child, you know, they really felt a sense of exclusion because of their body weight. Or they might tell you that actually they have a cousin who has a severe disability, and that's really given them some really insight into what it means to be disabled. So I think if we facilitate, whether we, again, we can call them lunchtime conversations or workshops, it really kind of, it keeps us kind of getting to know our colleagues and not assuming because we've worked with them for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, we've got to know everything about them. You can even have workshops where you pose a particular question, and that question could be a question around anything you like, but, you know, could be anything from, you know, what's your stance on the NHS to what's your stance on immigration. You have to be mindful of the sorts of questions you ask, because otherwise they can fall into some really heated debates. What they're really designed to do is to get a conversation going and not to assume everyone has the same perspective on life, essentially. And then, of course, you can still respect their perspective. So they're tiny things that we can do. But the point about this is that in terms of change, what we're aiming to do is to create a set of habits or organizational rituals which apply to tiny organizations as well as the larger ones, which just constantly build and keep us on our toes. So they build perspective and insight into people who are similar to us and people who are different from us.
Thank you so much, Dan. Once again, we're running out of time. Just when I want to keep going for longer and longer. I think that's really valuable. I really enjoyed that. Thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Can I give a final tip for managers?
Please do.
Which I think would be, even in tiny teams, is if managers are doing one-to-one, ask a fairly open question, like a checking question. How's it going? And also say, is there anything going on for you outside of work that I need to know? That's a really interesting question, because you're not prying into people's personal life. You're not saying, is there anything about your identity that you should tell me? It's broad enough to say, is there anything about what's going on for you outside of work that I need to know? And that opens the door for people to say, actually, there is something that's going on for me that I need to tell you. And again, it could be something fairly trivial, or it might be something quite significant, but it's a really good way of building trust and openness between colleagues who have worked together for quite a long time and who wouldn't necessarily instigate that conversation with their manager without the opportunity. And also, if you do it in a one-to-one meeting, it gives that conversation some context. So it's not, it doesn't feel kind of out of sync.
I love that. That's great advice.
Thanks again, Dan. That is brilliant. And just very finally, just remind our listeners, if they're looking to find out more about the work you do, where should we point them?
TheCedarConsulting.com. They can check out the website. And if people want to email me, they can email me via the website. And we've got lots of free booklets and toolkits and all of that. So I'm more than happy just to kind of share, give information out.
Outstanding. Thank you. And we'll, as usual, we'll link to those and the couple of other things we've mentioned in the conversation on happyporchradio.com. Thank you very much, Dan. And thank you, Kate, as always, making the conversation better than I do.
Thanks very much for having me again.
You can get all the links and notes from this episode on happyporchradio.com. Where you can also find out how to send us questions, feedback, and get involved in the conversation about this series. If you enjoyed the show, please share with anyone else who might enjoy it too. Thanks for listening.